I would like to introduce our next presenter. His name is Ed Bianchi. He's the coordinator of the Aboriginal Rights Program of Kairos. Kairos is a national coalition of churches that work on human rights and social justice issues. Before that, he was a national coordinator of the Aboriginal Rights Coalition. Ed has worked on Aboriginal rights and justice issues since the early 80s, when he co-founded a temporary-based support group for the Lubicon Lake Cree. In the past life, Ed was an independent filmmaker who specialized in documentaries on Aboriginal rights and environmental issues. I am pleased to invite Ed Bianchi. Thank you.
As Nora said in my introduction, I used to be a filmmaker, so I'm into visuals. So I always carry a lot of props with me when I do things, even if I don't use them. Kind of like my security blanket there. Thanks very much, Nora, for the introduction. I also want to thank the organizers, St. Thomas University, Andrea, the Atlantic Policy Congress, and all the people who are involved in organizing this event. I think it's very important, these kinds of events where we, you know, share our stories and talk to each other, are steps towards doing exactly what Paul was talking about in terms of addressing the causes of the problems that we're faced with. And I want to acknowledge, you know, Paul's very insightful presentation this morning, as well as the one by Bruce Wildsmith last night. And I also acknowledge the fact that I'm going to be talking more from the other perspective. I'm not a lawyer. I'm an activist. I'm on the other side of the bench, you can say. As Nora mentioned in the introduction, I was co-founder of an organization called Friends of the Lubicon, which was a Toronto, Ontario-based support group for the Lubicon Lake Cree Nation, which resides in northern Alberta. And so what we were doing at that time was trying to help people in Toronto understand more about the Lubicon people and their rights. And that's been a constant in the previous two presentations. This word keeps getting thrown out there, rights, Aboriginal rights, human rights. And what we found in our work, it involved this kind of event lots of times. We did workshops, we did speaking events, we did public demonstrations. We found out that in many cases, people knew the word but didn't really understand what it meant. They didn't understand, for instance, the difference between a right and a need. They didn't understand where rights came from. They didn't understand that as human beings, we all have rights, that those rights are inalienable, that they're equal. And so we would have to start our discussions way back at square one. And I think that that's what Paul was getting at when he talked about the need to change the culture. In Canada, we don't have a culture that respects and honors rights. We have a culture that pretends to do that. We have a culture that likes to think that it does that. We have a culture that internationally proposes or promotes itself as a country that is a protector of human rights. But in fact, our country expends a lot of efforts trying to deny and violate people's rights. So our work, and maybe I'll spend a little bit of time just talking a little bit about Kairos. It's a national coalition of churches. It's been working for about three decades now on social justice and human rights issues. It was formed in 2001, but the work of the coalitions that preceded it were been happening since the early 70s. So what happened in 2001 is that the churches amalgamated 11 social justice coalitions, including the Aboriginal Rights Coalitions. And what those coalitions have been doing for 30 years is educating people about human rights and social justice issues, and including Aboriginal rights, which began in the early 70s when with the Dene, at the time of the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline Inquiry Commission, contacted the churches and asked the churches to try and help get their word out. Again, help with spreading our story to Canadians so that it can be better understood. And that's the core of the work that we do, is to try and help more and more people understand what rights are all about and what Canada does vis-a-vis those rights. Because our belief is that the culture that Paul talked about will never change until Canadians, Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal, demand that it be changed. The Lhubicon Cree were promised a reserve back in the 1930s. They've actively been in negotiations with the federal government since the early 70s. They don't have a land rights settlement yet. The latest round of negotiations started in 1998 in July. So that was almost 7 years ago now. It's taken about 5 years to negotiate the terms of their settlement, which will be built around their traditional gathering place around Lhubicon Lake in northern Alberta. But the talks broke down about a year and a half ago over two things: self-government and compensation. One thing, the compensation, because the Lhubicon have the fortune, or perhaps misfortune, of living on what's probably one of the richest pieces of real estate in Canada. According to the Globe and Mail report on business, if you take into account all the natural gas, oil, tar sands, timber, and diamond reserves on their 10,000 square kilometer traditional hunting and trapping territory, it's probably one of the richest pieces of land in all of Canada. So now, since oil and gas development started in the 70s, about $13 billion has been taken out of Lhubicon territory, and not 1 cent of that has gone to the Lhubicon. So when the Lhubicon enter into negotiation with the federal government insists on treating it like a negotiation. And I'm sure Paul can talk more about this later, but this is from my own experience. So they treat it like a labor negotiation. So, you know, give and take, compromise. And what the federal government refuses to bring to the table, again, speaking to the culture that Paul mentioned, is the understanding that the Lhubicon have already compromised in that they have lost their traditional lifestyle and are trying to address all the problems that have come with the massive oil and gas development that has taken place on their traditional territory. And now they're hoping to have a situation where they can reap some of the benefit of the resources in order to rebuild. And yet Canada doesn't take that attitude. Canada goes in there and says, well, let's see, this much has been taken off of the territory, and, you know, there's about 500 of you, and, you know, there's like 30 million Canadians, so maybe this is how much, you know, you guys deserve from that, from those riches. That's the attitude that Canada brings to the table. One of the documentaries that I made in my past life, as Nora mentioned, was a documentary about the Lhubicon Cree. And in that documentary, one of the elders was talking about this issue of compensation. And he said, we're only asking for less than 1% of what's been taken off of our territory. And if that's, and the government doesn't want to give it to us. And if that's not greed, he says, I don't know what it is. Our role as a non-Aboriginal support group in Toronto, okay, in Lubicon Live in Alberta, was to try and bring the Lubicon story to people in Toronto to see if by mobilizing people we could affect some kind of change. Change that culture that Paul was talking about. So what did we do? In 1990, this multinational pulp and paper company called Daishawa was granted leases by the Alberta government to the entire traditional territory of the Lubicon Cree, 10,000 square kilometers. Leases to clear cut, because Daishawa has figured out a way to turn what were formerly considered weed trees or aspen poplar trees into high-grade pulp and paper. So now, this boreal forest that the Lubicon live on and from is set to be clear cut. So the Lubicon asked for some help. And the friends of Lubicon responded by calling a boycott of the Daishawa Paper Manufacturing Company, right? Japanese-based multinational corporation. So the first things that we had to do was bring people up to speed on the Lubicon story. So again, here we go. We're in Toronto, remember. You know, 4,000 miles away from where the Lubicon live, trying to help people understand what was going on. And the experience was, and speaking mostly to non-Aboriginal peoples about this, and the experience was that people didn't have much trouble understanding that it would be a bad thing to have your territory clear-cut when you didn't want it to be. I mean, they can sort of understand that. They have their own cottages and gardens and front lawns and so forth. They didn't have much problem understanding the fact that if you have something on your territory and somebody comes and takes it without permission, well, you know, that's not a good thing either. What they had trouble understanding was that Canada would do any of this stuff, right? Would violate people's rights in that way. Would be the bad cop in these kind of situations. They couldn't believe it. They really had a hard time believing that their government would do such a thing to anybody, and First Nations in particular. So again, there's that profound ignorance coming back to haunt us. I mean, the Royal Commission, for all its faults, was very useful in that it uncovered a lot of the facts that we, most people, didn't know about. I mean, half of those 4,000 pages is an historical account. All of those subsidiary documents that Paul mentioned, you know, tell part of the story. I think one of the reasons that it's been buried by the federal government is because it's got just way too much information. Canada doesn't want people to know about that stuff. So back to our boycott. This is an organization of, you know, Friends of Lubicon, okay? Volunteer, 12 people, you know, 6 regularly show up at meetings. Okay, so we said, what are we going to do here? How can we affect any kind of change on this situation? So we said, okay, let's boycott. Boy, we were much younger then. We're older than that now, is the song. But anyways, decided to launch this boycott. We did it in Ottawa at the Assembly of First Nations meetings. We brought in the Lubicon representatives. We had a press conference. We got a little bit of coverage. We identified 4 companies that used Daishawa paper products, and we started the boycott, November 1991. Within 4 years, we had 40 companies representing over 4,400 retail outlets in across Canada, and these were like major companies like A&W, Holt Renfrew, The Body Shop, Culture's fast food restaurants, and companies like that, Woolworths, that had joined the boycott. Okay, and actually it was you know, exceeded all of our expectations, that's for sure. And like these companies would join the boycott, and I'm sure not because they had much interest in helping the Lubicon, but because they didn't need the kind of hassle that we promised we would bring on them if they didn't meet our demand and change their paper suppliers in support of the Lubicon. Where the impact came was in the number of people that we were able to influence and educate during the course of the boycott. So remember, I said 4 years later, 40 companies, 4,400 retail outlets. In that 4 years, we did these kinds of things all the time. Where the publicity really picked up, though, and we always acknowledged Daishoa's help in this situation, was when they sued us. In 1995, Daishoa basically got fed up with what we were doing and sued us and said that we had cost them $20 million and that, you know, what we were doing was against the law, that we were invoking breach of contract. Maybe Paul can help me with some of these terms. But what they said basically was that we had broken all these laws and that they were going to take us to court. And we were fortunate to have very competent legal counsel, and more importantly, competent legal counsel that would work pro bono, in other words, that they would work without charging us. And we embarked on this court case that generated more publicity and that generated more support. We were in court for 3 years, and by June of 1998, Daishoa basically, after having lost a number of decisions, including the Ontario Court of Appeal, where the judge in that case said that not only were our actions legal, but that they were an example of how such educational activities should be conducted in a democratic society. So after that, you know, we said that we would continue the boycott. Daishoa tried to negotiate with us after that, and we said, you know, our terms haven't changed. And we just went out and started it again. And in a few weeks, Daishoa contacted the Lubicons and said, look, you know, we are prepared now to sit down and talk to you about not clear-cutting on your territory until your land rights are settled. And that was 1998. 9 years later, Daishoa still hasn't cut on Lubicon territory, even though they get pressure from the province to carry out the conditions of their lease at risk of losing it for not doing that. They still haven't gone back on Lubicon territory except for a number of small jobs with which they've gotten the permission of the Lubicon. So we were able to make a difference. In the meantime, we were able to educate a large body of people, a Lubicon network, you know, of primarily non-Aboriginal peoples in Canada, Europe, Australia, Japan, the United States, people who know the situation and know what the government of Canada is doing. Recently, the Lubicons finally lost patience with the negotiation process, which has been going on, like I said, this last round since 98. What basically convinced them that they couldn't rely on the good faith of the federal government anymore was the experience they had around the negotiations dealing with self-government. They were talking about self-government, and they were working on the wording for self-government. And the federal government said, well, let us go away and draft some wording, which I'm sure, you know, you will be satisfied with. We'll do that tonight. We'll come back tomorrow, and we'll see where we can go from there. So they broke for the day. They went their separate ways. The feds went back to Peace River and came back the next day with this draft wording around the issue of self-government. And the Lubicon said, this looks great, you know, but let us sleep on it. And they took it away and they shared it with some of their advisors. And one of their advisors shared it with someone in Ottawa. And someone in Ottawa said, well, this looks really interesting. You should see this. So he sent the Lubicon a copy of these federal negotiators' guidelines on self-government. And I'm sure Paul is familiar with this. And basically, what the feds had done is cut and paste from this document, right? This is the word that they presented to the Lubicon. What the words say is that, you know, it's written in a kind of way. Remember, these are guidelines for federal negotiators, right? So the federal negotiators are you know, workshopped about how to deal with First Nations when they bring up the issue of self-government. Okay, so this is the right to self-determination we're talking about here. Okay, this is a human right. Remember, I talked about human rights being inalienable, equal, and so forth. So here is the federal government instructing its federal negotiators on how to undermine and violate the human right to self-determination of Aboriginal peoples. And it basically says in there, it says, okay, when they bring up their first self-government, tell them that we'll put self-government-related issues in the preamble of any agreement. If they come back and say, well, it won't have the same force in the preamble as it does in the body of the agreement, reassure them that this is not the case and that, in fact, it will, even though that's a lie. And so that's what the federal team did that was negotiating with the Lubicon. So when the Lubicon confronted them with this, they denied it. They said, no, that's not that, you know, that's just something that, you know, we did in a workshop back in Ottawa. Who knows? I mean, I'd forgotten about that. But it was uncanny, the Lubicon said, about how the wording was almost exact to what was in the guidelines. So, to paraphrase one of the Lubicons, if that's not bad faith negotiations, then I don't know what is. And it's these kinds of stories that we would share with people during our boycott. And it's these kinds of stories that people found very hard to believe. And the Lubicon history, as with most, I'm sure, Aboriginal communities in Canada, I say I'm sure because I'm not familiar with all of them, the Lubicon history is one that's shared by all the communities, in that these kinds of acts of betrayal and deceit, duplicity, you know, happen all the way down the line. And we believe that they happen because people let it happen. And the reason, or the reason it is allowed to happen is because people don't know about it. If they knew about it, they might get upset about it and do something about it, just like they did in supporting our boycott. Just like they did recently when we put out another call, because while these negotiations are going on between the Lubicon and the federal government and the province, resource extraction activity continues, even though that's still acknowledged as Lubicon land, never been ceded in any way historically, legally. Okay, still belongs to the Lubicon under international covenants, you know, according to our constitution, according to the Supreme Court. We ran a campaign from the middle of February to the beginning of March. In that time, there were 17 wells approved on Lubicon territory, over 1,000 kilometers of pipeline, about 15,000 hectares of land leased. This is just in a 6-week period in this year. And how many tens of thousands of dollars that generated in royalties for the province. And yet when the Lubicon try and negotiate for compensation, the federal government says, well, we had a pot of money for compensation, but we spent all that money buying out the leases for the 95 square mile reserve that you guys have identified around Lubicon Lake. Okay, so think about that, okay? So here they've given leases away to land that doesn't belong to them, Now, in getting that land back, in order to create a reserve, they spent some money. So that's the money that they're going to take away from compensation. Internationally, Canada at the recent at the talks around the draft declaration on the right, the UN draft declaration on the rights of indigenous peoples. In December in Geneva, at the last meetings of the working group to try and come to some kind of agreement on the wording of this universal declaration on indigenous peoples' rights, which, by the way, you know, is kind of, you know, one would think it unusual that there are conventions on economic, social, and cultural rights, civil and political rights, elimination of racial discrimination, rights of women, rights of children, rights against torture, but there is nothing about indigenous people's rights. So these talks on the text have been going on for 10 years. 20, if you count how long it took to draft them in the first place, but 10 years they've been kind of talking about the wording to the text. There's 45 articles in the declaration. Two of them have been approved. The one that says all the rights the herein described apply to men and women equally, and the one that says everybody has a right to a nationality. States have agreed that they're fine with that kind of wording. 43 other articles, no agreement yet. The big problem is that indigenous peoples from all over the world are trying to play this game in the state's ballpark. Indigenous peoples come to these United Nations meetings, sit in the big room that's filled with representatives from all the states, and they try and negotiate wording that will enshrine their rights in the universal international document. Well, you know, 10 years later, two articles have been approved. This is the last year of the mandate for the working group. There's concern that if it doesn't happen before the end of the year, then all work on the draft declaration is going to stop. So Canada, up until now, has been very much an obstacle to getting the declaration passed. In December, Canada does an about-face. And it does this all the time, right? It does an about-face. And becomes very helpful with regards to one article, Article 3, the article on the right to self-determination. And Canada says, we support the text that has been put forward by the Indigenous Caucus, and we're prepared to stand by that wording. This is good. But it's kind of strange that it happened 10 years after Canada has been opposing it all the way down the line. So why does it do that? Well, we're at a meeting in Ottawa a few weeks after that, in January, with the Canada's main representative in these international forums, a man named Wayne Lord. And I asked Wayne, I said, Wayne, how do you explain the contradiction? You know, internationally, Canada has just supported this article on the right of Indigenous peoples to self-determination, while domestically, everything Canada does is designed to terminate that right, to, you know, assimilate First Nations, Aboriginal peoples, to absorb peoples into Canadian society. And Wayne says, oh, I'm really glad you asked me that question. He says, I didn't, and he looks to the other people and he says, you know, I didn't pay this guy to ask me that question. He says, because I want to make it really clear right now that all of Canada's international positions flow from its domestic position. Nothing happens international level unless it happens at the domestic level first. And people around the room just sort of sat there and, you know, nodded their heads and stuff. So here we are in a workshop with representatives from a broad spectrum of NGOs, non-governmental organizations, and civil society organizations, now it's the new term, CSOs. And nowhere in that room was there the understanding of Canadian domestic Aboriginal policy, enough of an understanding to challenge what Wayne said. So these some of these people, I'm sure, went home saying, like, wow, this is really good news. You know, Canada has, you know, turned the corner on self-determination, and now they, it looks like they're doing the right thing. So again, it's that ignorance, that profound ignorance that has to be addressed. And that's what we're doing, we're trying to do in our own humble way. In February, just last February, Nora and myself, the Atlantic Policy Congress in Cairo, helped organize a workshop at Dalhousie, a workshop on human rights, designed to bring people up to speed on what human rights are, how they can be used in advocacy, what are the international instruments that people can access to try and achieve some kind of justice, achieve some kind of change. There are some documents back there that were leftovers from that workshop. I've got copies of some of the articles in the Convention on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. The kit from that workshop is there. There's kind of like to give you an idea of the kind of things that we talked about. We're working closely, well, we hope to work with the Canadian Human Rights Foundation, and I noticed, ironically, right in the hallway there's the office for the Atlantic Human Rights Foundation, and the, what they do is they conduct these workshops on human rights training. How can we use these international declarations of human rights to further our own advocacy and justice work here at home? Because Canada takes this kind of stuff really seriously. I mean, internationally, for sure. We work with the Atlantic Policy Congress and a number of other organizations, the Southern Chiefs of the Southern Chiefs Organization of Manitoba, the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society, and Kairos, Canadian Council of Churches, to put together a submission on the condition of Aboriginal children in Canada. Because what was happening was that Canada was appearing before the Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, the UN Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. So Canada is the signatory to this convention. It's called the International Convention on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, which, by the way, has as its first article the right to self-determination, and says basically all peoples have the right to self-determination. So Canada has signed that. Canada has ratified it. So they're bound to that article. So when they violate Aboriginal people's rights daily here in Canada by trying to undermine that right, they seem to have forgotten that they've signed this international covenant. So every once in a while, every 5 years, Canada has to sort of like write a report and say, here's how we're complying with the convention. So this was a convention on the rights of the Committee on the Rights of the Child. Sorry, I think I said it wrong. Committee on the Rights of the Child. So we created this report that looked at some of the elements of the Convention on the Rights of the Child and focused on areas where Canada obviously is not living up to the convention. And we took this submission to this joint submission to the committee in Geneva and presented it to the committee. And the committee then used that report when it reviewed Canada. And like I said, Canada takes this very seriously. Most countries send like 4, 5, 6 people to these, you know, reviews. Canada had a delegation of 22 people. Okay? They had health, you know, Department of Health was there. Department of Justice was there. Department of Indian Affairs was there. There were representatives from Alberta and Newfoundland, Quebec, and the delegation was led by Senator Langdon Pearson. The committee found our joint report very helpful because, not surprisingly, Canada didn't have any of that information in its 500-page report. Okay, so Canada had originally filed a 300-page report, which the committee is made up of experts in this area from around the world, couldn't make heads or tails of. Okay, I mean, had great, you know, lots of pages, you know, but no information that they could use. So they asked Canada for some clarification and generated what they call a list of issues, and Canada came back with another 200 pages. So, you know, altogether they had 500 pages stacked before them, and still they didn't have any of the answers to any of the questions they wanted. So our 20-page submission, and I've got a few copies if you want, was very focused, and exactly what they needed in terms of being able to provide them with information that they can use in questioning Canada and reviewing Canada's compliance to the convention. So we talked about housing, we talked about education, we talked about self-determination. And the committee used that in its review of Canada. And in fact, if you look at their concluding observations or their report following Canada's review, you'll see reflected in it some of our submission's points. Well, it's a body of knowledge. It's a body of information that keeps building. And like I said, Canada takes it very seriously. So we thought that we would build on this, APC and Kairos, by bringing more people into the circle, broadening the dialogue, we called it, broadening the human rights dialogue. So instead of working together and producing another shadow report or alternate report for the UN when Canada comes up for review under another one of the conventions, and the next one coming up is the big one, is the Convention on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, we said, let's bring people more, bring people into this process, have workshops, help them understand what this is all about, and then include their observations and their learnings in our report to the UN. Because one of the requirements of Canada as a signatory to these conventions is that it tell Canadians about it. And Canada is really good at keeping it a big secret. I mean, they send a lot of people over there. They spend a lot of money at these delegations, but they never tell anybody about it when they come home. And there was a senator, Senator Lois Wilson, some of you may be familiar with. She spent most of her time while on the Hill trying to raise the profile of Canada's work at the international level. Because, like was said earlier, I think Paul said it or Bruce said it, Canada's got, you know, a fairly good reputation internationally for being a protector and defender of human rights. But and it really tries to protect that. And it's very sensitive to anybody who tries to sort of challenge that. And so it's very important that Canadians know about this two-sided, you know, approach to human rights that Canada continues to carry on at the international level. I mean, and it happens all the time. I mean, I'm going to use some of my props now. I know you guys have been dying to hear about all this. It's a tough crowd here. You know, okay, go back a few years. There was a, at the, we all, Kairos also submitted a report to the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. And our report focused on the fact that discrimination against Indigenous peoples in Canada occurred every day because of Canada's domestic policy, which tries to undermine the right to self-determination. And the committee raised this issue in its discussion with Canada. And Canada came back and they referred to it as the extinguishment policy, extinguishment of rights. And Canada's response, okay, official response to the committee was that Canada no longer practices or requires extinguishment in negotiations with First Nations. That's Canada's response. So we got the concluding report, and it said that, right? That the committee is very pleased to hear that Canada no longer requires extinguishment of right. Boy, we must have missed that. I mean, you know, why wasn't this splashed over, you know? Well, 3 weeks earlier, Canada had negotiated an agreement with the Tlicho people in the Northwest Territories. Because this is 3 weeks before the federal representative says, we don't require extinguishing anymore. They negotiated this agreement with the Tlicho. And lo and behold, the word extinguishment never comes up in the agreement. Instead, they say, cede, release, and surrender. So fall back, see release, and surrender. So in other words, it accomplishes exactly the same thing. So Canada is not above lying at the international level to try and protect its reputation. Some of you might remember the conference against, the international conference against racism in Durban, South Africa, where Matthew Kuhnkamp, who was then National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, made some comments about Canada and the existence of racism in Canada. And boy, you know, the reaction in Canada was as if, you know, this was something that just totally was wrong. I mean, you know, there was nobody coming up supporting the National Chief when he said that. Okay, well, Kairos wrote a letter in support, and it was so, you know, unusual that the AFN actually put it on their website. I mean, that's how rare it was. They needed some sign of support, okay? Well, why didn't anybody rise up to support? A couple of weeks later, the AFN funding gets cut by 40%. Okay, they have to drop 40% of their staff. Okay, I wonder why nobody else said anything. Just a few months ago, Bev Jacobs, president of the Native Women Association of Canada, was in New York at the Organization of American States meeting, where they're also talking about a declaration of indigenous rights, but one that applies only to the Americas. Okay? And the states, as part of the process, invited the First Nations and the indigenous peoples to the opening of the American Museum of the Museum of the American Indian, okay? And Bev Jacobs and Armand McKenzie, who's with the Innu, and a number of other indigenous groups, issued a press release saying that they weren't going to attend because they couldn't stomach attending an event that supposedly honored indigenous peoples while at the same time they were negotiating with states over a declaration on indigenous rights that was obviously trying to undermine their rights. So this is a contradiction. They said that we just can't stomach, and so we're not going. That was on a Tuesday. Bev Jacobs was expecting to, on Monday of the following week, be in a joint press conference with the federal government and announcing that the feds were going to provide the Native Women's Association with $5 million towards their Sisters in Spirit campaign, which is designed to sort of like find out more about the missing Aboriginal women, missing and murdered Aboriginal women in Canada. So Monday is Valentine's, it's supposed to be Valentine's Day, February 14th. Tuesday before, Bev Jacobs issues this press release, basically saying they can't attend the opening of the museum. On the Friday, Bev Jacobs gets a message from the Prime Minister's office saying, we're going to have to postpone that press conference because, you know, there's been some problems with, you know, the money that we promised was going to be in the budget. Yeah, it's just a coincidence, I'm sure. But again, internationally, Canada plays hardball when it comes to this kind of stuff. As long as you toe the line and don't say anything, you'll be okay. But as soon as you start to say something that might have any sort of resemblance to the truth, then you might get in trouble. This is fine, but the problem is that not enough people know about it. Our task at Kairos, and there's a brochure back there that explains a little bit more about what we do, and you'll see that we work in all areas of the world, economic justice and, you know, human rights in Latin America, Asia, Africa, is to bring this message to more people. Because we believe that the change will happen, the change of that culture that Paul Williams was talking about will only happen when enough people know about what's going on and care about what's going on. I want to read to you, this was up from the biennial convention of the Liberal Party of Canada. Okay, it just happened, in February in Ottawa, I think. And this was a resolution that came out of one of the workshops. This was the Aboriginal workshop You know, so the party has all these workshops, and they all come forward with these resolutions, and then these resolutions go to the plenary, and some of them are accepted by the plenary. And so this one is the resolution number 22 on certainty. And what essentially it addresses is the policy of extinguishment. So the policy that the federal representative in Geneva told the Committee for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination didn't exist. This is the resolution put forward by members of the party that says, whereas a major obstacle to the settlement of outstanding claims is the inclusion of modification language which extinguishes all or parts of existing Aboriginal rights and title, a contrary to the Crown's fiduciary obligation, and I would also add contrary to human rights and the rights of Aboriginal peoples, and whereas extinguishment clauses do not provide certainty for either party, as evidenced by the dispute between parties to historical treaties, and then it's got Mi'kmaq in brackets, and modern treaties, and it's got James Bay in brackets, both of which contain extinguishment clauses. Therefore, be it resolved that the Liberal Party of Canada urge the Government of Canada to revise the current treaty policy requiring an extinguishment of Aboriginal rights and title, bracket, in any modification language, bracket. So addressing that part about, you know, it's not just the word we're worried about, it's the whole policy. So be it further resolved that the Liberal Party of Canada encourage the Government of Canada to affirm and comply with underlying Aboriginal rights and title defined by the Supreme Court of Canada in the treaty process so that all parties may achieve certainty without eroding these recognized Aboriginal rights and title. So that resolution was put forward by the Aboriginal workshop on March 5th to the plenary, but it wasn't accepted. So, in other words, it's still official party policy to extinguish Aboriginal rights and title, and in other words, to violate the Aboriginal rights, the rights of Aboriginal peoples, including the right to self-determination, which is Article 1 of both of the international covenants that Canada has ratified at the international level. So, there's the culture we're talking about. It's a culture of bad faith. Every negotiation that Canada enters into is designed to extinguish rights. How can it go right? The talks that Bruce was talking about yesterday, I mean, Canada can only go so far. I mean, its policy handcuffs it. Like the Lubicon have said, getting back to them, they said, it doesn't matter who you have as a negotiator. You could have, you know, name him or her. It wouldn't matter because when you get to that one point, Canada can't do anything further. So until people, I think, understand that what we're talking about here is a fundamental rights issue, I don't think there's much hope for any kind of rapid change. Because Canada's just going to keep doing what it's doing as long as it can. So our job, I think, is to sort of like keep spreading the word so that we can get that critical mass of people that will make some kind of difference. Thanks very much for your patience.